It's Wednesday, August 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, the battle for Aleppo intensifies as casualties mount in Syria. Travel delays persist for many Delta airline passengers.
Dry peatland has become the gasoline for any triggers for the fires.
Neighboring countries could again feel effects from Indonesian fires. Also ahead, what can you say about the Olympics? Well, for some, very little. And politics goes off-Broadway. It's all on today's International Edition. Syrian government forces and rebel factions poured hundreds more fighters into the battle for Syria's largest city, Aleppo, where a rebel assault that captured part of a military complex and broke a three-week government siege of rebel districts has intensified the battle, seen as crucial in the five-year conflict. Regional analyst Amin Saikal of Australian National University tells VOA's Victor Beatty that this could shape up as a decisive battle in the Syrian conflict, as Aleppo represents a key prize for both sides.
I think it's shaping up as a very important battle, and that's why both sides are investing very heavily in this fight, because the rebels really want to break the siege of Aleppo altogether, but at the same time, the Assad regime and its supporters, Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, would want to really take over Aleppo. And I think for that reason, this is going to be a very important fight.
Did the rebel offensive launched late last week surprise you, given how much territory it captured at the expense of government forces?
I think it did surprise many analysts, but at the same time, one must not really forget that the United States and its allies have been saying for some time that they would like to provide as much assistance to the rebels as possible, and I think this is what has really happened. And of course, the latest report also indicated that some of British special forces now are operating in Syria, and that was reported by the BBC overnight.
One analyst in Edinburgh said that whoever wins in Aleppo, the war will not end. It is, however, an important battle, the result of which will set the course of the conflict. What say you?
The analyst is right in the sense that this is not going to put an end to the either Syrian conflict or Iraqi conflict altogether, simply because that as long as the conditions which have really given rise to the current situation in Iraq and Syria persist, there is always room for various groups to rise and challenge the central authority and also fight one another. One must not really forget that Syria is a very politically and territorially fragmented state and totally destroyed state in many ways. And various groups operating in different parts of the country. So it's just simply because if the Assad regime and its supporters succeed in taking over Aleppo, one could not really expect the war to come to an end, or at least the conflict to come to an end. But by the same token, if the rebels succeed in defending Aleppo and breaking out of Aleppo, that also does not mean that the war is going to come to an end.
But he said a rebel victory could mark a turning point in the war. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which monitors the conflict on a daily basis, said that more than 290,000 people have died since the war broke out in 2011. It's time now for our social media segment. And as always, our G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio with the trending online topic. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. A very unusual selfie is dominating the Rio Olympics tweets, and it's a selfie by South and North Korean Olympic gymnasts that's been around since Friday. And I'm sure you've seen it, have you?
Yes,
yeah,
I have.
That's very cute. The female athletes were talking and laughing before competing to qualify for the artistic women's gymnastics, and the North, Hong Eun-jung, advanced to the next level, but the South, Yi Eun-ju, didn't.
Well, I see the selfie. I did see that, but tell us how the photo came out to be trending on social media.
Sure. It seems like president of Eurasia Group, Ian Bremmer, is the one who made it visible on Twitter. His handle is at Ian Bremmer, and he also teaches at NYU. He tweeted the photo and captioned it, "Gymnasts from North and South Korea take a selfie together. This is why we do the Olympics." The photo is by Reuters. Since August 5th, more than 2,100 people retweeted that, and just as many people liked that tweet.
Big reaction. Mm-hmm. Well, let's check out some of the media reaction to it.
Sure. So Business Insider touted it as the most iconic photo from the Olympics, and a nonprofit called Liberty in North Korea, or LINK, also shared the photo on its Facebook. Now, the top comment to LINK's post reads like this: "Honestly, I am just wondering about how the North Korean athletes feel about such cultural exchanges. It would be impossible for them not to learn what's really happening outside their country." She was, of course, pointing out the reclusive nature of the Kim Jong-un regime, but another user named Stephanie replied, "They are probably from elite families who have access to much of the same things the rest of the world has, minus freedom of speech and movement." But Jim, I have to say that statement is unlikely to be true. Instead of coming from elite families, the athletes are more likely to have been picked at an early age to train specifically for that sport. It's also interesting to note that some people tweeted about how they weren't even aware that Pyongyang sends its athletes to the Olympics. So that's a testament to how much the world knows or doesn't know or care about the country. Jim, back to you.
Very interesting. Thanks for that wrap-up, G. You may tweet us your comments and questions to at VOA _IE. That's our International Edition Twitter stream. Myself and G are also on Twitter at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories trending in Asia: tensions escalate between China and Japan over disputed islands. Thailand junta leader says elections will take place in November 2017. Indian activists to end 16-year hunger strike. Washington grills Manila's envoy about alleged insult of U.S. ambassador. Indonesia prepares for another dangerous fire season. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Hundreds of people spent the night Monday into Tuesday at Japan's Narita Airport near Tokyo as a result of Monday's computer outage that halted Delta Airlines flights worldwide. While flights were resuming Tuesday, delays persisted. Narita is the hub for Delta flights throughout Asia. The carrier is offering refunds and travel vouchers after having to cancel 700 flights, with thousands more experiencing delays. Delta CEO Ed Bastian posted a video apology.
"I apologize for the challenges this has created for you with your travel experience. The Delta team is working very, very hard to restore and get these systems back as quickly as possible. For those of you who have been inconvenienced and need to access and make changes to your travel plans, we have instituted system-wide waivers, and you can access those through either Delta.com or by talking to any of our reservation agents. I appreciate the hard work the Delta team and the Delta people are doing to bring our system back up as quickly and as safely as possible. And once again, apologize for any inconvenience this has caused to you, our customers."
An investigation did not turn up any evidence the Delta computer network was hacked, but officials do not yet understand why backup systems did not kick in. A similar chain of events struck Southwest Airlines 3 weeks ago, and there have also been technical malfunctions at United and American. Last year, some of the biggest fires in recorded history raged through Indonesia, and it sent a haze of smoke across the region and pumped enormous quantities of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. One culprit was the palm oil industry, and with the fire season set to begin again, exacerbated by the El Nino weather pattern, or exacerbated, efforts to reform the industry will soon be put to the test. We have more from David Boyle in Sumatra.
The richly colored fruits these men are harvesting on the Indonesian island of Sumatra might look harmless, but they are a contributing cause of both local and global environmental catastrophes. Strong international demand for palm oil to use in snack foods and cosmetics has made the cash crop a ubiquitous sight across millions of hectares in Indonesia. Much of this was once peatland. It was dried for agriculture in the cheapest and quickest way possible, illegal draining and burning. This practice has fueled some of the worst fires in recorded history, creating a haze so enormous it spreads to neighbouring countries and can release more carbon dioxide than the entire United States.
Dry peatland has become the gasoline for any triggers for the fires.
Woro Supatinar runs the Network for Riau Forest Rescue, a non-government organisation that tracks fires and deforestation through satellite data and community monitors.
Riau province has lost around 5 million hectares of natural forest. And now, currently, we only have 1.6 million of natural forest that from 7 million that we have in late of 80s.
But for the first time, plantation policing has stopped the fires, says Edouard Sanger, head of the National Disaster Management Authority in Riau.
Even if there is an El Nino effect this year, we have already made a commitment that what had happened in the past years will not happen again.
Puck Dilan has worked with the government to minimize the environmental impact of his community's 1,000-hectare palm plantation in Dosan village. By blocking canals once used to drain their plantation, they can let palms grow but keep the land sufficiently moist to minimize fire risk.
During that time that we planted palm oil on the plantation in this village, it was still a new thing. We didn't know how extensive the impact was. We only realized its impact now.
The community has its own firefighters, and for the sake of future generations, they compost palm branches to rejuvenate the soil. Other communities in Riau are experimenting with similar strategies and are even cutting down parts of their own palm plantations to plant a more diversified mix of crops. With the worst of the fire season set to hit soon, these efforts will be put to the test. David Boyle and Laura Villadiego for VOA News in Sumatra.
As the world's best athletes compete in the Rio Olympics, many of the amateurs among them are having to watch what they say on social media. That's because of something called Rule 40, an International Olympic Committee regulation that restricts what those amateur athletes and the companies that sponsor them can say on Facebook and Twitter. It was a topic of conversation on today's hashtag VOA TV show, and host Michael Lippin is here to tell us how it went. Michael, what's the deal with Rule 40?
Hi, Jim. Well, that restriction that you mentioned applies to sports brands and other companies who sponsor Olympic athletes but are not themselves an official sponsor of the Olympics. Now, the IOC's Rule 40 basically says neither those companies nor the athletes they sponsor, typically amateurs, can mention each other on social media for a one-month period starting 2 weeks before the Games. Now, on the show, we spoke via Skype to Christopher McCashew. He heads Canadian sports marketing company Sprint Management, and he's a critic of the IOC regulations. He joined us from Montreal and told us about how some people are trying to protest Rule 40.
There's a great initiative that came out. Well, it only came into fruition a few weeks ago. It's Who Did It. Brooks Running Company, based out of Seattle, Washington, put together quite an aggressive little advertising campaign around the United States Track and Field Championships, whereas they rented some, I'll say, moving trucks and put up some quite interesting little, I will say, propaganda, for better choice of words, essentially saying that it's not fair that companies like them and others don't have the rights to advertise or even talk about the Olympics during that Olympic period. There's been a couple figures on social media, such as myself, that have really been pushing the fact. And I mean, I've had some tweets that have over 85,000 impressions, and it's definitely showing that not only athletes but fans of the athletes are saying, hey, this isn't right. With all this money being generated via the IOC rules with TV time, why can't we put in place some sort of revenue sharing similar to the NHL and NBA and these major organizations have in place for professional athletes? At some point, there has to be some give and take. And the way I see it is it's all take right now for the IOC and all their great partners that do support them.
Well, another guest on the show was Cameron Myler. She's a four-time U.S. Winter Olympian in the sport of luge. who now teaches sports management at New York University. I asked her what she thinks of the IOC's argument that it needs Rule 40 to protect the big brands that sponsor the games.
Well, you might be surprised to hear what I have to say. So I, not only am I an athlete, but I'm also an intellectual property lawyer. So I definitely see both sides of the argument. And it is, I think, a very delicate and nuanced balancing of rights between those of the individual athletes and the rights of the commercial partners of the International Olympic Committee. So, and by the way, Rule 40 is not new as of last year. Almost the exact same rules were in place for the London 2012 games, and this year they have been eased a bit with the exemption that was referred to earlier. But I think it's important to understand that 90% of the International Olympic Committee's revenue comes from sponsorship and broadcast rights. And almost all of that money goes back out to National Olympic Committees, to International Federations of Sport, and to other organizations that ultimately support athletes. So the IOC's revenue is critical to make the games in Rio even happen in the first place. So it's a difficult issue. I understand that athletes want their personal sponsors having some airtime during the games, but it's not a new rule, and everyone has known what the parameters of this rule are going into Rio and really well in advance of the games.
Well, for more of that conversation, which included another former U.S. Olympian, a 10-time medalist in Olympic swimming, Gary Hall Jr., you can go to our website, www.voanews.com/#VOA. You can see the show there and also on my Facebook profile, Michael.Lippin. Jim, back to you.
Michael, thanks so much. A timely topic. Check it out, the Olympics on #VOA. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. It was an iconic moment when Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian Liberation Organization Chairman Yasser Arafat shook hands on the White House lawn back in September 1993. Two enemies came to terms on an historic peace agreement, but that agreement was forged during months of secret back-channel talks in Norway. A new off-Broadway play, Oslo, looks at this little-known part of the peace process. Jeff London reports.
The most important piece of scenery in Oslo is a door. On one side, the negotiations. On the other, a husband and wife who never cross the threshold.
Men are killed. Tire people are rioting.
I know it's tragic, but these are perfect conditions for progress. The desperation they are feeling on both sides. This is our ally.
Tyre Rudd-Larsen was a sociologist and academic, Mona Jewell, a young foreign service officer. She had been posted to Cairo, where they got to know people on both sides of the conflict. When official talks between the parties in Washington, D.C. stalled, the couple arranged for both sides to meet secretly in Norway without the initial approval of their government. Tyre Rudd-Larsen is now president of the International Peace Institute.
And we did it in a way, exactly the opposite way of what was done in Washington. We did not put proposals on the table. We said we would facilitate, bring the parties together, be go-between, assist them in any way, saying it's your problem, you have to resolve it yourself. And we don't want to push anything on you. And number two, we said that the delegations should never exceed three persons on each side, because trust is dependent on personal relationships. And then we also insisted that they should live in the same house. They should have all meals together, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. When there were breaks, they could go for walks together, etc. They had to live together.
The sociologist was testing a theory. But playwright J.T. Rogers says the story behind Oslo is anything but a dry academic treatise.
It was very clear that it was a thriller, because it was. The ticking clock is the drama's friend.
And the actors who play the Norwegian couple, Jennifer Ely and Jefferson Mays, say that's how it feels every night.
We are continually surprised by this play, the doing of it. It feels like an ambush. We never know exactly what's going on or
what's coming next.
I have a copy of my script backstage at all times that I continually refer to.
I have little sheets in my pocket that tell me what's coming next.
So there's something about doing this play that feels like a wild improvisation.
Tyler, this is not something you make up as you go along. If this fails, Fafo, the ministry, our lives will all be torn down.
No, you must trust me more than you have ever done before. I know how to do this. I see how to do this.
Oslo is based in part on extensive interviews playwright J.T. Rogers did with Rod Larson and Jewel. He wanted to explore the intersection of the personal with the political.
The hope was to make a political play in the Greek sense of that word, a play about the public and the larger ideas about who are we as human beings and as nations, and how do we go forward, and how do we live with our enemies and with ourselves.
Oslo suggests an answer.
If you bring the right toolbox and handle the tools the right way, there are also possibilities today. Because there is one similarity with the situation at the time of Oslo and the time of today, that is that everything looks impossible. And sometimes the impossible is easier to do than the possible. If you have resilience and are persistent, you can do things which nobody believes is possible.
And critics and audiences have responded to that message. The off-Broadway run at Lincoln Center is sold out, and it was just announced that Oslo will move to Broadway next spring. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And for director Tracy Carter, engineer Zinam Abdel-Rahman, I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to International Edition. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Russian aggression continues in eastern Ukraine. According to U.S. Ambassador to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, Daniel Baer, the situation in eastern Ukraine remains grim. Combined Russian separatist forces have claimed the lives of more than 63 Ukrainian soldiers and wounded some 327 more since June 1st. This bloodshed is eroding confidence on the ground and hardening attitudes, said Ambassador Baer. This violence needs to stop. That's why the United States strongly supports the OSCE's efforts and those in the Normandy format to find a peaceful solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine caused by Russia's aggression. The Special Monitoring Mission, or SMM, must have access to disengagement sites and throughout the conflict zone, including up to the international border. Restrictions on their movement regularly occur along the parts of Ukraine's internationally recognized border with Russia that are under the control of combined Russian separatist forces. The SMM continues to identify clear and continuing evidence of Russia's direct involvement with Russian separatist forces. The SMM continues to find weapons systems in separatist-held territory that are only in Russia's arsenal. Moreover, OSCE monitors have recorded large numbers of individuals in military-style dress crossing the internationally recognized border from Russia into separatist-held parts of Ukraine. Only a credible ceasefire will protect civilians from greater harm and create the conditions that will allow Ukraine to move forward with the political aspects of the Minsk agreement. President Barack Obama and other U.S. officials have been clear with Russian President Vladimir Putin that sanctions will remain in place until Moscow fully implements its Minsk commitments. Crimea-related sanctions will remain until the peninsula is returned to Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. You may also comment